This is Sciographies, an introduction to people who make Canadian science happen.
I'm David Barkley, co-host and an assistant professor in the Department of Oceanography.
I'm Shauna Bullman, co-host, neuroscience student, and science communication intern.
I'm Nicole Comeau, and we're all from Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science. Hi everyone, this is actually our last episode of Sciographies for the year. So before we start the show, we want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, sharing, and rating our show. And of course, Dalhousie's campus radio station, CKDU 88.1 FM, they've been an awesome partner in getting Sciographies off the ground this summer. A special shout out as well goes to our wonderful co-hosts, David and Shauna. Now, Shauna was away for the recording of this particular episode, so David held down the fort as we spoke with Jeff Don. Dr. Don is an industrial research chair with the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada and Tesla Canada. He's known as one of the world's pioneering developers of the lithium-ion battery now used in portable electronics, power tools, electric vehicles, and large-scale energy storage. His work has been recognized with a number of high-profile awards, including NSERC's Gerhard Hertzberg Gold Medal for Science and Engineering in 2017. In this episode, he tells us about his upbringing just outside of Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, his career moves from government to industry to academia, and how he landed the first research partnership Tesla ever made with a university professor.
So you grew up a little bit in Connecticut?
Yeah, we grew up. I lived in the U.S. until I was 13.
Then came to Nova Scotia and presumably to Halifax?
We came to a small place outside Lunenburg called Center and settled on an 83-acre farm that's sort of not operating as a farm, but was once a farm.
And what was the motivation?
Well, my parents had been holidaying in Nova Scotia and taking the kids on the trips, and we all liked Nova Scotia a lot. This was in the Vietnam era. And there were three sons, one of them me, and my mother was a big peace activist. She ran an organization called York, Pennsylvania Action for Peace, and she organized bus trips to Washington and marches. And, you know, it was, in her opinion and my father's opinion, time to leave.
So, and going back, you said you were 13, so you were pretty well-formed?
And I would say I wasn't really that well-formed.
Okay.
I was in a middle school of about 2,000 students.
Yeah.
For grades 7 and 8. Then I came to Nova Scotia and went to a school that went from primary to grade 12 and had 400 students. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting was in the small school with about 40 students in my grade, you really had to get involved. Whereas in a large school, it was difficult to get involved in sports teams because there were so many kids. You know, so I started playing soccer and basketball and became quite good at both. You know, and that wouldn't have happened if I had stayed in the U.S.
Was there like a culture shock aspect to that, or did you enjoy the opportunity that you
afforded? It was fantastic. Yeah. You know, you go from just being a statistic to somebody that was important. You know, I was able to do well in school and be at the top of the class in the smaller school. And, you know, it was really quite fun. I think it really developed my leadership capabilities.
You kind of described how you had a little more alienation maybe in the U.S. or maybe a little less certain of maybe your path.
Yeah.
And then when you came here, you felt, I'm going to be an academic or I like studying.
Well, I got to tell you, I was really a sports guy.
Yeah, okay.
Right? It was in high school, really sports that was on my mind.
Did everyone love living on the farm?
I think everybody, the move was really fantastic for all of us.
You did your undergraduate work, and now you're here at the other end of your career.
I came to Dalhousie and and made the soccer team here.
And okay, so you came, and that was that like your decision to go to Dow was to play soccer at university level, or?
Well, No. I was hoping to, you know, do an education in the sciences, and I wasn't sure if I would do chemistry or physics. Mm-hmm. But the goal was, while at university, to certainly try to play soccer too. Sitting in first year physics, I had Ernie Guptill, who was absolutely fantastic as a lecturer. He was beyond belief. And in chemistry, I had a person I won't name who was less wonderful. And that's what made me choose physics over chemistry. It was one or the other.
I mean, you ended up doing a little bit of
doing a lot of chemistry now in my research, but yeah. You know, at the time it was physics.
Yeah. Interesting. And that decision to go to grad school, was that kind of an easy one, or?
Yeah, it was very easy. I really enjoyed physics, and I enjoyed the lab and research, and it just made sense. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents said, "Do what you like, and it'll work out." You know.
Yeah.
If you love it, do it, and it'll work out.
That's familiar sounding advice.
Yeah.
The UBC, you went with no real research topic in mind.
Well, you know, I'm not a guy that sits around and lets grass grow under my feet. So I think it was the second day I got there, I started talking to the various professors about their work. And I talked to this guy named Rudy Herring, and he was captivating. He's working on what are called intercalation materials. They're solids that you can put little atoms or molecules within the existing spaces inside. And he had this model on his desk, and he took a piece of chalk and he put it inside. You know, he said, "Jeff, you know, when you put these little atoms in there, all kinds of things happen. Insulators can become metals. Something that's red can turn black. You know, it's really fascinating." And I just thought that sounded so cool.
Yeah.
And then later on, it turned out that these materials started becoming used as battery electrode materials.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your grad school experience was, were you playing soccer as well, or were you pretty focused on just the studies?
Well, I only had 1 year of eligibility left when I went to Vancouver. So I played at UBC for 1 year, but primarily a lab rat.
Sure. You were living and breathing.
You know, it was, people would say, you know, here it is, it's the weekend, you're in the lab, why aren't you outside doing whatever? And I said, well, you know, this is what I want to do. It's really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You finished up your PhD pretty quickly.
Yeah, I was 25 when I got my PhD, and
God,
you know, I mean, there's no point going slow.
And right away into government research, right?
Yeah, there were some decisions about what to do after the PhD, so I had an offer to do a postdoc at Brookhaven National Labs, or to go to the NRC and work with a fellow named Ross McKinnon. So Ross McKinnon had been a graduate student in my group 2 years before me, and he is a very, very bright guy. And together at the NRC, we did a lot of good things together, and I've always said he was the brains and I was the hands. You know, I was the experimental guy, he was the theoretical guy, and together we just clicked.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we published, I don't know, 30 or so papers in the 3 years I was there.
Wow. Yeah. 30 papers in 3 years. I mean, I guess I know it's different in every discipline, but that sounds prolific.
Well, now my group is more like 30 to 40 every year, but the group is 25 people.
Sure.
It's a big operation. Yeah. In those days, it was just the two of us, really. Yeah.
That's amazing. What were you doing research-wise at this point?
Yeah, at the National Research Council, we were really trying to understand the fundamentals of these intercalation materials. Yeah. You know, you put lithium into the structure. How does it change the voltage versus composition of the material? You know, if you change the composition of the host a little bit, what happens? A lot of very basic fundamental understanding of these materials that would then go on to become the classes of materials used in the batteries of today.
Right. And was the research kind of coming from a more like a tweak the recipe formula, like an engineering, let's optimize this material? Or was there a lot of theoretical background that was kind of motivating the different changes?
Well, there was a lot of development of experimental tools that mm-hmm. didn't exist. So a lot of these so-called in situ methods didn't exist.
Okay.
And we were lucky enough to develop quite a few of them and then apply them to the study of these materials for the first time.
Okay. So you go to grad school and you get the idea to study these materials from an inspiring professor. You have a very successful PhD. You go on, get on in this great team. You got this team set up where you're producing tons of work. Is there ever a moment where you think, okay, now we've hit the peak, we've hit the jackpot?
When I was in my grad work, it was really interesting and cool to see that these things had commercial application, but I wanted to do this more basic science academic thing, which is why I went to the NRC. But after 3 years at the NRC, I decided to go to the company Moly Energy after 3 years at NRC and hopefully have my work have a more, you know, more of an impact on society and be useful.
You've raised this great point that there needs to be, you need to have some applied question that you're answering, right, with your science. And certainly your research does that. And most research does answer a question, but it's like, how esoteric does that question get? And like, is there value in every question?
Basic science has a huge role. You know, I made the choice to say, look, I have a choice. I can work on A or I can work on B. And I decided to work on something that has more immediate benefits to society,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think, and the questions in those areas are just as challenging as in basic science too. You just have to pick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of the lithium battery stuff, obviously the writing was on the wall that this would be revolutionary technology from probably day one of grad school.
I wouldn't say it was so clear in mm-hmm. day one. You know, we had a lot of trouble getting a decent charge discharge cycle life from in the early days, and those cells used lithium metal as the negative electrode.
Okay.
You know, and when I worked at Moly Energy, we were commercializing cells with lithium as the negative electrode, and I guess in 1988 we had a manufacturing plant and we started shipping product into the NEC laptop computer and the Nippon Telegraph and Telephone cell phone. And in the cell phone application, we had situations where some of the cells were emitting smoke and flame in the devices under normal use.
Emitting smoke and flame. It sounds like you still work for the company. That's a very controlled message.
Well, I mean, that's what they were doing.
Yeah, sure.
They weren't exploding like a hand grenade. They were just emitting smoke and flame. It's very different.
Wait, hang on. And the year is, you said 83?
This was about 89.
89. Okay. Still, I mean, it's remarkable. Think of cell phone lithium battery. You're supplying
The cell phones were the size of a brick
back
then.
Still, it's crazy.
They were massive. Great. Yeah, and anyway, this issue with the cells with lithium metal led to a complete recall of all the product.
Did you have an idea what the physics was when you had this recall, this runaway energy
problem? Oh, yeah. Yeah, the problem with lithium metal is when you start with a nice, smooth piece of lithium metal, and when you charge and discharge the cells, you strip the lithium and then you electroplate it back.
Yeah.
And after you do this many, many times, the plated deposit becomes incredibly mossy and furry, and it has huge surface area that's in contact with the electrolyte in the cell.
Right.
And the lithium reacts with the electrolyte in the cell at high temperature. So all you need to have happen is some event, an external short circuit, an inadvertent crush, a charger malfunction where the cell gets overcharged and heated, and then the cell will, this high surface area lithium will react with the electrolyte and create smoke and flame.
So when you were faced with the original replating problem, were you launching whole hog into fixing that, or?
No, we were going around it.
Yeah.
We were basically saying, look, we don't believe we can make a battery that's safe with sure. lithium metal.
So that's
we have to use lithium ion.
Okay. And what motivated the move back to academia?
Well, you know, it was kind of like I've tried government lab, I've tried industry, mm-hmm. I haven't tried university. I was fortunate to get a faculty position at Simon Fraser.
Yes.
So I left Molly, you know, and it's funny because when I went to Simon Fraser, the chairman said, Mike Plischke said, you know, Jeff, new faculty members, we don't usually make them teach the first year because we want them to establish their research and all of this. I said, Mike, I want to teach immediately because I want to see if I like it. And if I hate it, I'm leaving.
So right away you knew that you wanted to stay.
Yeah, I enjoyed the teaching side of it, and the research side of course was fun. I was doing that before. So yes. It turned out to be a almost ideal job. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. You know, the majority of my teaching is first year physics for the scientists and engineers. Yep. The main thing that I want to get across is and convey and try to nurture is the ability to think on your own.
Sure.
Right? So the kind of problems that I set are those where you can't go to the phone and find out what to do. They're all about conceptual things where you have to think.
In 96, Dr. Don finished up at Simon Fraser to move east. He had actually worked out a deal to become an NSERC industrial research chair with 3M, and that was the career move that brought him back home to Nova Scotia and, of course, Dalhousie University. Since co-host Shauna was away at the time of the interview, David found out what Jeff Don is up to now.
Okay, so when you came to Dow, you were associated with 3M. That was for a period of 5 years.
20.
20 years.
20
okay,
years.
Renewed a few times there.
Yeah.
And you went straight from them to Tesla, or was there a period in between? What was that change?
Yeah.
How did that change happen?
Yeah, so it was 2014, and I was in my fourth term of an industrial research chair with 3M. 2 years left to run till 2016. And at that time, Elon Musk announced that Tesla was going to build a gigafactory in the United States. And I just thought, this is so cool, because at the moment, virtually all lithium ion cells are produced in Asia. And then to have a large fraction of the world's production in the North America would be really, I think, very cool. So I just said to myself, I have to be part of this somehow. So the director of battery technology at Tesla at the time was a guy named Kurt Kelty, who I knew for many years. And I phoned him up and said, Kurt, you know, I'd like to, when my 3M deal ends in 2016, you know, what about we have a partnership, you guys sponsor me in an industrial chair and we'll try to help. Move battery technology forward. And Kurt was pretty excited. He said, yeah, so fly down to Tesla and we'll talk about it with J.B. Strobel, the CTO. So I remember the advice Kurt gave me. He said, 5 slides, man. You can have 5 slides for J.B. That's it. You know, because he's very busy. And we had a meeting at lunchtime, and JB was very busy. He came late. He came with his lunch. He said, you know, I have to eat my lunch, otherwise I'm going to starve, so go ahead. And I got into slide one, and he said, wait a minute. I want to see your lab. Do you have pictures of your lab? And I said, well, oh, yeah, I have a website. It has a lab tour. Let's go to my website. So I went to the website. We went through the lab tour, and he's asking, you know, what does this do? What does that do? What does this do? What does that do? And the clock is ticking. I have a half an hour. I'm midway through slide one, you know. And finally, JB says, okay, let's go on with your presentation. We really didn't have too much time to discuss the whole thing. And at the end of it, he said, okay, I got to come and visit you. right? I got to come and visit and see your lab and check it out. So it was November of 2014, and he was in business in Europe somewhere, and he was flying back. He said, I'll fly through Halifax. I have a meeting in somewhere in New England Monday morning, but we can spend the early part of Monday morning together and have dinner Sunday night, and I can see your lab. And I said, well, listen, JB, I teach 500 students at 8:30 on Monday morning. He said, fine, we'll start at 6. I said, that's fine. We can start at 6 because that's when I usually start when I'm teaching anyway. So we had dinner on the Monday. Kurt Kelty and JB came to the lab on Monday morning at 6. I toured them around, talked to them about our capabilities and what we would do if we were involved with Tesla. And then when I went off to teach, they stayed and met with some of my graduate students from 8:30 to 9:30, and then they went to the airport to go on their trip. You know, it was that visit when they saw the things. JB said during the visit, he said, you know, I visit a lot of battery labs, but yours is the one, is you have so many simple things that you guys do that can teach a lot. Things that don't cost $1 million that cost a lot, that can teach a lot, and it's unique. And I think that's that sort of simple approach convinced them that it was worth working with us. Yeah.
Did they give you a car? That's
no.
What everyone wants to know.
No.
That wasn't part of the deal.
No.
So what's the main focus of your research in the lab now?
Yeah, so we've entered a partnership, a research partnership with Tesla in June of 2016. And they've really given us three goals to work on, three things. And they are decrease the cost of lithium-ion cells, improve the lifetime, and improve the energy density. So that means store more energy per unit weight or volume. So that's all we do.
Okay.
But each of those is a very difficult problem.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes down to materials challenges mostly. New materials for the electrodes to improve energy density, changes to the electrolyte to improve lifetime, all with an eye on cost, right?
Yeah.
You can't use expensive things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a conversation with one of the founders of Tesla, Martin Eberhard, in 2009 at a conference. It was a conference where EV owners had their vehicles parked in the parking lot at lunch, and you could go out and drive them and talk to them and whatever. So I went out there and it was a total zoo. You couldn't get it near anyone. So in the afternoon during a crappy talk, I went out there and there was this guy standing next to a red Tesla Roadster. And I introduced myself and he introduced himself. He was Martin Eberhard, co-founder of Tesla. And I said, Martin, you know, I'm a battery guy. What do we need to do to make these batteries better for your cars? And he said, Jeff, take a look at this car. Can you sit in it? Yeah, you can sit in it. He lifted up the front hood. Said, can you put your luggage in there? I said, yeah, you can put luggage in there. He opened up the back. Can you put luggage in the back? Yeah, you can put luggage in the back. He said, this car goes 240 miles. The batteries are good enough. The problem is they cost too much. Mm-hmm. If they were five times cheaper, nobody would buy a gas-powered car. No one.
Yeah.
And, you know, that completely changed my way of thinking and really brought home the message of cost reduction.
Yeah. Do you think about the big picture of energy and energy consumption a lot? Obviously, it's not a focus of your research, but do you have an interest in where our energy comes from?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a whole part of this whole thing is where does the energy come from? Where mm-hmm. should it come from? You know, in my opinion, it should come from renewables. It mm-hmm. should come from the sun. It should come from wind. Mm-hmm. And those should be the main sources. And the biggest problem with them is they're not always available. So what do? You have to store.
I was going to say tidal, but.
You have to store energy when it's available for later use.
Right.
And this, without doubt, is the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Going fully renewable is we don't have the storage piece of the puzzle worked out yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think there's a future in tidal energy here in Nova Scotia?
Oh, I think there's definitely a future. It's just a question of working it out. The cost of tidal energy at the moment is not competitive with solar and wind.
Yeah.
So it's going to be tough to get in.
What about, you know, in the battery game, what about competition with mechanical solutions? Like, you know, when the sun's out, can't you just pump some water up into a reservoir and use that later?
That's pumped hydro is the absolute best way of storing energy. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
But all the good sites have been more or less tapped out. So if you have the sites for pumped hydro, it's great. Mm-hmm. But there's not that many sites. Here in Nova Scotia, the Cape Breton Highlands are a pretty good option for pumped hydro. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have an ex-Dalhousie graduate, Danielle Fong, who started a company in California called LightSail, where they're compressing air in tanks and using very humid air to try to reduce the energy consumption in compression,
right,
and the heat generation in compression. That company at the moment is in sort of hibernation. It's wasn't successful in its first go at the technology, and maybe it will come out of hibernation. I don't know.
So you do keep your finger on all the possible solutions to our energy needs.
Yeah, you look around and you say, how are we going to solve this storage problem? What is it going to be?
Yeah,
you know, and at this exact moment, lithium ion is the best candidate on the table.
Yeah,
and you know, and a lot of research has to go on to look at other alternatives. And Dalhousie is trying to get involved in other alternatives in its Clean Technology Research Institute.
Right.
Redox flow batteries and other new technologies.
And that wraps up our final episode of Sciographies for this year. We'd like to thank Jeff Don for being a guest on our show. And if you're interested in hearing more about his work, he's actually delivering a public lecture here on campus Thursday, September 27th, and you can get all those details at dal.ca/science. If you're looking for a way to support the next generation of physicists getting trained at Dalhousie, Dr. Don's lab members actually created a bursary in his name for his birthday last year to support a first-year physics student from Nova Scotia in need of financial assistance. Learn more about the Jeff Don Bursary in Physics at giving.dal.ca. And finally, you can stream all Sciographies episodes on various podcast apps or at dal.ca/sciographies. Thanks for listening.